Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, which one do you want to fix first? Housing or banks? Or maybe you want to do them both at the same time? Today, the Obama administration rolled out more of its plans to save them both. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 25th of February. Great to have you here today. We have been hoping against hope for what seems like forever now that the housing market's about to turn around. And there was a glimmer of a chance last month when the December number for what are called existing home sales ticked upward just a little bit. Well, that hope was dashed today. The report for January that came out this morning shows those sales declined faster than expected, down where they haven't been in a dozen years. I'm sure the Treasury Secretary's schedule was set before that report came out, but it certainly gave a boost to his communication staff. Timothy Geithner went on the PR offensive this morning, plugging an $8,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers that was in the stimulus bill. The White House is counting on that credit to bump the housing market up a bit, since the government's figure show nearly half of all buyers last year were first-timers. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
The $8,000 tax credit is available to first-time buyers all year. And it doesn't have to be paid back. Some states even allow the money to be handed out like a rebate at the home sale closing. The administration hopes the money will spur first-time buyers to sign their lives away on a home mortgage. Carrie R. of Frederick, Maryland, wants to be one of those property virgins. R. says what he really needs is down payment assistance.
I don't have a lot of money saved up. The last 2 years I've been paying off credit card debt.
Unfortunately, paying off your debt or help with a down payment is not part of President Obama's housing plan. But it does include measures to reduce home foreclosures. And the Federal Reserve is trying to drive down interest rates on mortgages. Real estate analyst Mike Larson at Weiss Research says the incentives will make a bad housing market a little bit better. But he says, don't expect a buying frenzy.
You'll see some buyers that were already considering buying take advantage of that tax cut, but it's certainly not going to spur a huge new wave of home buying, in my opinion.
Larson says the real reason people have stopped buying homes is because they lack job security in an uncertain economy.
The average American's worried they're not going to have a job next month or next year. They're just not that likely to buy a house because they're afraid their income's going to go away.
But spring is the traditional home buying season. Most analysts expect some sort of sales bump from the tax credit by late spring or early summer. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Once he was done with his housing announcement, the Treasury Secretary walked across the street to the White House. He and President Obama met with congressional leaders to figure out how to prevent the next financial crisis.
Strong financial markets require clear rules of the road, not to hinder financial institutions, but to protect consumers and investors, and ultimately to keep those financial institutions strong.
Regulation is another way to say rules of the road, but Washington regulators already own a big chunk of some of the biggest banks in this country, and the problems there don't seem to be getting any better. So you have to ask, how many regulators is too many? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Hal Scott sums up America's system of financial regulation in just four words.
Highly fragmented and ineffective.
Scott's a Harvard law professor and expert in capital market regulation. He says right now, so many different agencies are in the regulatory mix, it's almost impossible to know how many.
One person counted 200 because there are a number of regulators at the state as well as the federal level.
You might think this would make our financial system safer, but actually it allows banks to shop around for regulators they like. And both state and federal regulators depend on fees from banks to survive.
What that does is create competitive pressures among regulators. It's the classic race to the bottom.
Scott says first the administration needs to figure out who's in charge of keeping an eye on the biggest institutions. Then make sure all the different agencies, like the Fed and the SEC and state regulators, are talking to each other. But Bill Black, who's a former bank regulator, believes streamlining the system's not enough. He says Congress needs to launch an investigation aimed at fraud and abuse in the banking system.
we would consider it insane if someone came out and said, no, we're not going to do an investigation of why these recent plane crashes have occurred. That's backward-looking. We want to be forward-looking.
But that's the line on Capitol Hill now. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Not that it's any of my business, but have you been on any good company golf outings lately? Nah, I didn't think so. A lot of companies are cutting back on those kinds of things, what with mass layoffs and a dismal economy. But you may have heard about Northern Trust's golf tournament over the weekend, the one with the Tiffany bags and performances by Sheryl Crow and the band Chicago. Northern Trust has taken more than $1.5 billion in TARP money, so as you might imagine, the bank is now in some hot water with Congress over that little party. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports the financial industry is still figuring out what's okay and what's not.
Northern Trust says it didn't use any taxpayer money for the golf tournament and didn't want any to begin with. We've heard that line before.
They get it, but they don't get it.
That's Paul Hodgson with the Corporate Library. He says corporations, even the ones funded by taxpayers, are still adjusting to the new landscape, which he says is all about restraint when it comes to entertaining clients or employees.
If you want to provide a party for your employees, it needs to be at the local amusement park rather than in Disneyland or some other exotic location.
Julie Jacobs is at the center of the world of corporate events. She's the director of sales for Watson Adventures, which organizes scavenger hunts for companies. Well-known names like AIG, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns.
We've had some clients who really go over the top. I mean, probably the most over the top is they had some of our staff fly out to Hawaii for a week-long sales meeting.
Jacobs defends the concept. She says there is value in getting employees to bond outside the workplace. But she says if Citigroup called her tomorrow asking for a week in Vegas, she might still take the money. But
honestly, inside, it would kind of sadden me if a company like that that was really struggling would be spending that kind of money. Because I really believe there are ways to accomplish that without spending that kind of money.
Morgan Stanley seems to have gotten the message. The bank said today it will not entertain clients and executives at its golf tournament in June, though it will remain the sponsor. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, started ugly, got better, ended bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Make of this what you will, but Variety reports today that Rupert Murdoch's not satisfied with just the Wall Street Journal. Seems the chairman of News Corp has his eye on the Los Angeles Times or perhaps the New York paper of the same name. I don't know if anybody's clued him in, but newspapers and the companies that own them haven't been doing so well lately, a slide that's only been exacerbated by the recession. As more readers and now advertisers drop away from the Daily Metro paper, executives are searching aggressively for new business models. I asked former McClatchy newspaper editor David Westfall whether there isn't advertising in online news, too.
There is advertising. It's just that it's $1 for every 10 that has been on the print side of things. And so when you talk about moving online at the present day anyway, you're talking about a tremendous scaling back of operations. And that is underway now, but it's only begun for a lot of people. And for many newspaper companies, they're so over-leveraged, so in debt, that it doesn't work.
Well, that's a great point. And we should point out the Tribune Company, which owns the Los Angeles Times here in town, is in bankruptcy in large part because of its debt. How much of a problem is it that the corporations that run some of these newspaper enterprises are so overburdened with debt?
Right now, it's the thing that's killing major metro newspapers. There are 1,400 daily newspapers in the United States. I would guess the large majority of them are actually doing all right. They're being hurt by the recession, they're being hurt by the internet, but they're still making pretty decent profits. But the major metros, and especially the ones that borrowed billions of dollars to expand, are the ones that are in real trouble now.
Let me quote Paul Steiger to you. He used to be the executive editor at the Wall Street Journal. He now runs ProPublica, the nonprofit news gathering operation online. He said, there's nothing wrong with journalism that can't be fixed by a new business model.
Well, I think
oversimplification, right? But what are you going to do?
That's clearly the case. I think it's a very frustrating situation now for someone like me who's been in journalism for most of four decades to be in a situation where you can't see the next business model. And I think that is the limbo that we're in. A lot of people make the good point that the public's demand for news and information has really gone up, not down or stayed the same. It's gone up. The problem is that there is not, as you say, a business model around the next spin that we can look at and say with confidence, oh, I can see where the money's going to come from.
As you talk to people in the newspaper business, what other models are they playing around with out there?
Well, there's an interesting one. I've been doing some reporting on this lately, and that is the startups that are online only and that are very small, in some cases one-person operation, in some cases two or three, that are, however, more just focused on city government, city politics, development, and the kind of the core city. They don't try to do everything. They try to do kind of the fundamental civic pieces that are important to a metropolitan area's operation. And we're seeing those develop rather quickly, actually.
Sure. And then what do newspapers do, though, given the rise of those smaller online enterprises?
I think they're going to come back to meet these small operations. In fact, there are some experiments underway right now supported by the Knight Foundation where a Metro Daily is going to cooperate with one of these new startups.
What about different revenue models? There's been talk recently about endowment-supported newspapers. There's talk of microfinancing in some degree. Do you buy any of those?
Well, I'm at a point where I'd like to see any idea float around because I think it's impossible to know. I do think philanthropy might well be involved, and if we think about a metropolitan area that has multiple news sources, not just one big one, a philanthropist might well endow an investigative reporting operation or endow a science reporting operation. But again, I think it's smart at this point to put everything on the table.
David Westfall ran the McClatchy Bureau in Washington, D.C. for many years. He's currently the executive in residence at the Annenberg School of Journalism at the University of Southern California, just down the road. David, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks.
President Obama's hoping third time's a charm with his latest cabinet pick. Today, former Washington State Governor Gary Locke was nominated to run the Commerce Department. Yesterday, former Representative Hilda Solis was sworn in as Labor Secretary, and her confirmation has brought new hope to advocates for workers' rights. They've been trying for years to convince Congress to pass something called the Employee Free Choice Act. It would make it easier for workers to organize and stiffen penalties for the companies that try to stop them. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports now on the latest political struggle between labor and management.
For a sense of what's at stake for both sides, all you have to do is turn on TV.
The Employee Free Choice Act will let workers choose to form a union to get better pay, health benefits, and job security.
Some union bosses and their politician friends want to effectively do away with privacy when it comes to voting on joining a union.
The number of unionized workers has shrunk from 30% in the 1950s to only 12% today. At issue here is a struggle over how new unions are formed. Current rules require the government's National Labor Relations Board to run a secret vote for employees to decide whether to create a union. Setting up the election takes a while, and that gives employers the upper hand, says Mary Beth Maxwell, who runs the union-funded American Rights at Work.
Tens of thousands of workers a year are illegally fired for trying to exercise their right to form a union. It's an incredibly effective tool to scare people. Because if you can lose your job tomorrow, in these kinds of economic times, who feels like they can take that kind of a risk?
To discourage that kind of intimidation, the Employee Free Choice Act increases penalties on employers and grants illegally fired workers more back pay. The act allows workers to sign cards to petition for a union, and if 50% plus one of the employees sign the cards, the union is approved, without a secret ballot election run by the government. Opponents, like Rob Green at the National Retail Federation, say that makes workers subject to intimidation from union organizers.
If an organizer shows up at an employee's house at dinner time or in a parking lot, many cases a card is signed, and it's not an indication of whether or not a union is favored. It's just done to say, hey, I signed the card, I'll move on to going back to my job.
But Mary Beth Maxwell says workers don't worry about union intimidation.
Everybody who gets up and goes to work in the morning knows who has the power at work. It's your boss. And that's where workers are experiencing intimidation and harassment. And that's what the Employee Free Choice Act is trying to remedy.
And the AFL-CIO Stuart Acuff says without greater collective bargaining protections, nothing less than the American middle class is at stake.
Corporate America had it their way for 30 years. Our wages have declined. Our standard of living has declined. It's time to balance the economy, to make an economy that works for all of us and that promises to give our kids and grandkids the same kind of opportunity, the same quality of life that we've enjoyed.
But opponents in Congress, like Minnesota Republican John Klein, a member of the House Labor Committee, say expanding union membership isn't necessarily good in the current economy.
If you look at the legacy costs of the auto manufacturers, they have union contracts that are weighing them down. And so there are implications for the economy as a whole if this were to pass.
The Employee Free Choice Act, which passed the House last session but not the Senate, will be reintroduced in the next few weeks. President Obama says he'll sign it if it reaches his desk. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Coming up, the green economy and the dash for cash.
Run the numbers, it requires billions, if not trillions of dollars of investment. That's got to come from somewhere.
But first, let's do the numbers. About all you can say is it could have been worse. After a very rough morning, the Dow Industrials ended the day down just 1%, relatively speaking, just. It's 80 points, closed at 72.70. The NASDAQ gave back 1.1%, 16 points, ended at 14.25. The S&P 500 lost 1%, 8 points, finished at 764. Most financial stocks avoided the down escalator for a change. Bank of America ticked up 9% after CEO Ken Lewis said he thought the bank could pass the government stress test. JPMorgan Chase added 3.3%. Wells Fargo gained 3%. Citigroup lost 3%, though. Insurance stocks took a hit after cutting dividends. Lincoln National shed 14% after cutting its dividend by 95%. Allstate handed back 5.75% after reducing its dividend by half. The trend toward dining in fed Del Monte stock. The food maker share shot up nearly 15% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. The White House releases the federal budget. FDIC Chair Sheila Bair reports the bank and thrift industry's fourth quarter earnings for 2008. And on this day in 1919, the Grand Canyon became a national park. I'm Jean-Luc Renaud.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The president had a lot of things he wanted to say last night. The speech ran almost an hour. About two-thirds of the way into it, he started talking about fiscal responsibility and how he's going to cut the current deficit in half by the end of his first term. Commentator Robert Reich says that might be smart politics, but it doesn't make much economic sense.
We're in a deepening recession, in case you hadn't noticed. The biggest immediate challenge is to ramp up aggregate demand. If the slump gets worse, we'll have to have a second stimulus. And if that's not enough, a third. FDR's biggest mistake was spending too little, at least until World War II. Can we continue to borrow indefinitely? Not without paying higher interest rates to attract global savings. But no reason to worry now. The Chinese and Japanese are not going to yank their money out of treasury bills because the slump is worldwide, and T-bills are about the best and safest place to park savings. Besides, the Chinese don't want the dollar to plunge. They'd be stuck with a lot of paper with less than they paid for, and their exports would be in even worse shape than now. Blue Dog Democrats and many Republicans will continue to fuss about the skyrocketing debt. The very word trillions, when juxtaposed with the word dollars, is enough to send most people into shock and awe. So it makes political sense for Obama to promise fiscal responsibility, especially with his first budget emerging this week. But if the economy needs further boosting, that promise could become a political liability. The real issue here is the ratio of debt to the national economy. Today, debt is under 50% of GDP, but it could be much higher 6 months from now. Getting that ratio down to a reasonable level depends not just on reducing long-term deficits, but more importantly, on getting the economy growing again. And to get the economy growing, two things have to happen. First, the stimulus has to be big enough to create a lot of jobs and move the economy toward capacity. Second, the nation has to make the public investments necessary to enlarge that capacity, including investments in the health and education of our workforce. Cutting the budget deficit in half by 2012 would be nice, but it's a sideshow compared to these two main events.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Supercapitalism. Send us your thoughts about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says Contact. If there's one thing this economy is teaching us, it's that there's no such thing as a recession-proof job. Companies in all kinds of industries are laying people off. Pay and benefits are being cut. You could say, though, that some jobs are more recession-resistant than others. For Washington lobbyists, business is booming, thank you very much. Ronnie Radbill reports.
Washington lobbyists earned a whopping $3.2 billion last year. That's the highest amount in the decade tracked by the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. Executive Director Sheila Krumholz says interest groups spent $17.4 million on lobbying every day Congress was in session last year. And with Washington on a spending spree, companies are boosting their influence on Capitol Hill.
There was this unique opportunity that government was handing out money, and anytime that happens, companies will spend what they must to get in line to get a piece of the pie.
And that's expected to continue. Craig Holman is a governmental affairs lobbyist with the nonprofit group Public Citizen.
The amount spent on lobbying is not related to the disclosure or the regulation of the lobbying profession. It is related entirely to how much the federal government intervenes in the private economy.
In other words, the more active the government, the more the private sector will spend to have its say. The Center for Responsive Politics finds oil and gas firms were the big spenders in 2008, hoping to have a hand in future energy policy, while the automotive industry scaled back. And with a new administration, lobbyist Chuck Brain, president of Capitol Hill Strategies, says business is good.
At this point in, I think, any cycle with the new president, the phone is ringing quite often.
And it's expected to keep ringing as new clients sign up with lobbying firms. With the White House injecting billions of dollars into the economy, lobbyists say interest groups are paying a lot more attention to Washington than they have in a very long time. In Washington, I'm Ronnie Radbill for Marketplace.
One quick footnote to that booming business down on K Street. Apparently, green is in. There's a report out today from the Center for Public Integrity that says the number of green lobbyists has tripled in the past 5 years. There are now nearly 2,500 people employed trying to get their clients' views heard on climate policy. Wall Street, in particular, sank a lot of money into green. Tax breaks meant they could write off every dollar they put into wind or solar farms. But as their profits dried up, so did their thirst for green. That is, until the stimulus package tossed them a lifeline. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
By injecting billions of dollars into renewable energy projects, the federal stimulus package aims to do one thing: fill the financial void left in the wake of the banking crisis. New Energy Capital CEO Scott Brown says the number of big banks willing to finance wind and solar projects has dropped from nearly two dozen to a handful.
Lehman, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wachovia, all of those players essentially are now out of the market.
taking with them the principal funding mechanism that made renewable energy the fastest-growing source of power. Roan Resch with the Solar Energy Industries Association says the federal stimulus package narrowly averts a catastrophe.
We have literally hundreds of projects that are in the queue. We've got thousands of installers ready to go and warehouses filled with equipment. What we were lacking was the financing to get these projects off the shelf and moving forward. We now have that through the stimulus bill.
But how effective the stimulus bill will be depends on how fast the new federal funds are spent. The Department of Energy has about $6 billion to loan out at low interest rates, but it's known for working at a snail's pace. The stimulus package will also pay back 30% of the cost to build a wind or solar farm. The only problem is the developer still has to come up with the other 70%. Kevin Walsh heads GE's Renewable Energy Financing Group.
It's not a perfect fix because even the debt markets are constrained now.
Walsh says GE is actively looking for investment partners, but these days they're hard to come by. And this is where the stimulus package may change the renewable energy landscape. New Energy Capital's Scott Brown says the old system of tax incentives involved so many legal and financial hurdles that only the biggest projects were worth funding. Now, he says, direct federal grants could blow the market wide open.
So using a grant structure like this should enable small developers to build small projects, which otherwise wouldn't get built even under the old tax credit structure.
Simply because it's easier to come up with the remaining 70% of the funds on smaller, less costly projects. But GE's Kevin Walsh says the money in the stimulus bill may not be enough to reach President Obama's goal of generating 25% of the nation's energy from renewable sources by 2025.
Run the numbers, it requires billions, if not trillions of dollars of investment. That's got to come from somewhere.
Walsh says the stimulus package primes the pump. Let's just hope the economy doesn't freeze the lines. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you might have thought that after the bailout bill, Congress was done shelling out money. Not so. This afternoon, the House passed a $410 billion spending package. It'll keep the government running for the rest of the fiscal year. That's until September 30th. And bearing firmly in mind that appearances are sometimes everything, lawmakers took a little skin out of their own hides, too. They turned down an automatic pay raise they had coming to them, $4,700. They like to call it a cost of living adjustment, by the way. Still, Congress is a pretty good gig if you can get it, $169,000 a year for the rank and file. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 80 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ fell 16 points, 1.1%. There, the S&P 500 lost 8 points. That is 1%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineer the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, the fears over franchising.
You have to paint the walls a certain way. You have to put merchandise on your shelves a certain way.
And what happens if you don't? What happens to you?
You may lose your right to operate that franchise.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.